Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Greg Wester, who is CMO of Mobile Posse, which is a mobile content discovery platform. So we talked to Greg from our studio in San Francisco about the trends he's tracking and the best practices he's exercising. So here's our discussion with Greg. So Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, it's great to be here with you.
Absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into everything I just mentioned. But first, let's start with a quick intro for you and Mobile Posse for those unfamiliar.
Super. Thanks, Mike. So Greg Wester, I'm the CMO at Mobile Posse. Mobile Posse is a software and services company that serves wireless carriers and OEMs. We help them get a foothold in the digital media space by providing to them software that they install on their smartphones to hopefully make it a whole lot easier for their subscribers to find and consume the media that they love without having to install, open, search, and wait for content to be served up from their different apps.
Yeah, there's a lot there we can sink our teeth into, and a lot of trends we're actually watching from kind of an analyst perspective, where what you're providing aligns with a lot of macro trends. So we look forward to getting into that. But what we're going to do first, as we like to do in the show, is to find out more about you for context, and to hit the rewind button and go back to the beginning of your career to find out kind of how you got into all of this, and then kind of walk back to the present. So let's do just that. Tell us about how you got into all of this at the beginning.
Sure. So I always loved math and science, Mike. I actually graduated with a degree in electrical engineering, but came out of school in a time when the defense industry was everybody hiring, and I was honestly horrified by the opportunities within the defense industry.
Sure.
I got very lucky and wound up being hired onto a management training program at GTE, which is now Verizon Wireless. In my time there, I met really my first mentor. He had a master's in science and marketing science from MIT. He was really the one that introduced me to the concept of math behind and for understanding people. And he really set me on my path towards marketing. I wound up going back and getting some further education in marketing and market research, and that really launched me down my career away from engineering into marketing, market research, and becoming an analyst and winding up in startups.
Yeah, and does that constitute the field of behavioral economics? That's always something that's fascinated me, is looking at this collision of psychology and mathematics and economics.
And oddly enough, I had a minor in psychology in undergrad, so whether it constitutes that formally or just for me personally, it certainly did. And it's that often conundrum between technology and psychology and consumers that I've always relished kind of being in over my career, certainly from different aspects.
Yeah,
and I've been in it.
That gets into things like pricing strategy and all kinds of things that are very applied. But one thing that we have in common is, you spend a lot of time as a research analyst. That's something that myself and colleagues consider ourselves in terms of industry watchers. And there are, of course, many different flavors of analysts. When you say the term, most people have the connotation of financial analyst, like you work at a kind of research arm of an investment bank. What I do is kind of an industry analyst, where we kind of zero in on topics, get smart about them, publish stuff about them, and that kind of thing. It's great. So that leads me to the next question. Is one thing we always like to kind of drill down on with our guests is the unique mosaic of skill sets that they've had, that they've picked up throughout their career. I like to call it cross training, whether that be a deliberate path or a serendipitous one. So, as a research analyst, as your background and your affinity towards mathematics, what does that overall mosaic look like for you and kind of position you for kind of what you're doing now. And then buried in there too is the reason why we like to ask this question is, you know, for folks that are earlier in their careers, whether they be would-be entrepreneurs or trying to pick their career path, about, you know, just trying to kind of assemble or devise a strategic path for themselves about things that are valuable to have as skills, whether they be soft skills, hard skills. So what does that look like for you?
Well, honestly, it looks like a lot of serendipity, I have to say. I certainly had, over the course of my career, have had lots of left brain and right brain experiences. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that it's that mosaic that you speak of that has served me well in my current position and in my prior positions, coming out of engineering, which is rather technical, where we focused on building and testing and quantitative aspects, moving into the qualitative or quantitative research that you might do at an analyst company, to starting my own company and being a solo player and dealing with finances and everything else, to actually becoming a parent and becoming a much better manager of people. It has really all kind of helped me become who I am now. I would say, looking back, while I did not seek those experiences, I would probably advise folks to seek out those uncomfortable experiences, because many of those were, and they can come in the most unique and unexpected places. I recall I was at, this is going way, way back, Mike, but as a summer job in college, one of my first jobs was doing inventory for a woman's fashion company. And one day the manager said, everybody's sick, come out and get on the sales floor and start selling. Mm-hmm. And that was my first real exposure to selling. But that experience for 3 months actually served me very well.
That really does embody the term cross-training more so than a lot of the kind of guests we have. And, you know, one thing I've always admired is the, you know, technical background, your engineering background, for example, in the C-suite. And in the worlds of kind of tech and media and ad tech, there's surprisingly little kind of, you know, engineering and technical background in the C-suite. But, you know, when that those things collide, you know, engineering background with business sense and leadership, I mean, that's when you have, you know, folks like Eric Schmidt or Elon Musk or some of those people we all look up to that really just combine those skill sets. So I think that's great. So now let's kind of...
I'm flattered by you even mentioning me in that same sentence.
Sure. So now let's actually, you know, that brings us back to the present. Now let's go deeper on Mobile Posse. So you provided us kind of a high-level explanation. So let's drill down on that. So tell us more about, you know, the value proposition, the points of differentiation, and perhaps, you know, tell that story through the lens of your main product, FirstFly Mobile.
Firstly,
certainly. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that name, though.
FirstFly, yeah. Excuse me, yes, Firstly, as in, you know, primary... And
seen first.
Yeah, temporarily mm-hmm. speaking as well, exactly.
Right, right. So no surprise to anybody listening on this podcast, but we're now in a very mobile-centric society. We spend more time consuming media on our mobile devices than on our television. But while the phone or the smartphone is 12 years old, the way the phone is designed hasn't substantially changed that much, even though our usage has changed dramatically. We, 15 years ago, would never use our phones for television consumption or to kill time or to read the newspaper or to read a book, but we do that on a phone every day. But still, we have to search for the app that we want. If we don't have it, we have to install that app. We have to open for the app. We have to hope for great connectivity. There's a tremendous amount of what we would call friction in the smartphone interface for media consumption. So in the simplest of terms, Firstly Mobile makes it easier, if it's installed on a phone, for the content that, Mike, you love and that I love to find me as I use my phone throughout the day without having to go and install and open a bunch of different apps. We can certainly talk more about the various products and how they specifically work, but at the highest level, that's what Firstly Mobile does. a suite of products to make it easier for you to find the content that you know and love. And in doing that, we actually serve our primary customers, which are the wireless carriers and OEMs, by making it easy for them to get into the digital media space, because we do it in a turnkey fashion.
Yeah, it's interesting. One kind of anomaly for me throughout my career as a mobile analyst, which goes back to, you know, the late 2000s, the time the iPhone came out, is the fact that this app paradigm is so prevalent, and it's almost illogical when you see, you know, because there's always been this kind of, you know, apps versus web type of discussion throughout the smartphone era, and the web, you know, on paper has so many greater benefits in terms of interoperability. You start to see that with deep linking within apps, but we're talking about a siloed environment, to your point, and it really just, it doesn't make a lot of sense as a front end, and I think it's really a function of, you know, Apple's gravitational pull in providing that, and just being, having such a large market share in really just pushing that as the model. But it logically, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So let's talk about your constituents. Like you mentioned, you know, there's carriers, there are, you know, advertisers that probably use this platform in some ways, and then also users. Like being user first as an experience is something that kind of underlied your explanation just then. So maybe let's start with users, and then we'll go into some of those other constituencies. So as a user, what is the experience like? If you could describe, like, walk us through what that's like, and the, you know, the value proposition for users for having that as a front end, or as a kind of a primary or first point of entry to the UI.
Well played, Mike. Well played. So I tend to answer that question with another question, which I'll then answer myself for you. Right. But that question is, you're standing online at Starbucks in the morning, and you pull your phone out to fill those 5 minutes of time, and you're a savvy analyst, so you like to feel informed and knowledgeable. So your process is, you pull your phone out, you close the other, whatever app you had, and then go swiping and swiping and tapping, and you find whatever is your favorite news application. You wait for it to load as it struggles, because it's trying to figure out if you're authenticated on Starbucks or not. Mm-hmm. You may have to turn that off. Finally, you get it loaded, and by the time you're ready.
And go back to the settings to do that. Yet another kind of switch you need to do, right?
Exactly. And by the time you've done all of that and it subsequently loads, you're ready to order your coffee. So that in that 1 minute, there's very little efficiency in you actually achieving your goal. With our product, our primary product, which is called First App, our agent is working for you while your phone is closed, while you're not using it. So in that same exact circumstance, you get to Starbucks, you unlock your phone, and the first thing you see would be a set of fully interactive, full color, full screen content that's been curated for you without you having to close the prior app, swipe through your home screens, open another app, realize you were being blocked on the internet because you weren't authenticated, fix the authentication. And so it really just makes it so that you're one touch away from the content that you love, just a tap or a swipe and the content's there for you. Mm-hmm.
Now, that's also interesting because it seems like, as I mentioned earlier, the timing, I think, is right with a lot of other macro factors that we're mm-hmm. observing. And one of those factors is, you know, a feeling of, you know, not being safe, and whether it be like data collection or whether it be like the Wild West atmosphere of the mobile web, which, by the way, I think is one of the things, a negative in the mobile web column that has caused apps to rise up, because it's, you know, safer and polished, the environment that Apple has created. So along those lines, having, you know, a highly kind of safe / curated front end experience seems to be aligned with the affinities of users today in kind of wanting that, because having seen the opposite in you know, again, unsafe data collection practices, you know, just having a safe environment seems like it resonates today. So how do you feel about kind of the timing of what you're offering with kind of everything that's happening in kind of a macro environment?
Well, you're spot on again. And I would really break that down into three different factors when you talk about being safe. One is the curation of content being defined as appropriate and safe. The second, I would say, is really protection from a growing potpourri of rogue ad technology, from malware to interruptive JavaScript ads that take over the device. And then finally, you mentioned privacy and the increasing penchant for safe use of my data and me being in control of my data. The great thing about working with carriers, Mike, is that they certainly care a lot about that on all three. So our platform really has a blend of human and automated curation of the content. It's really required to make sure that what we're putting in front of carriers, subscribers, is appropriate. But also in the rogue ad space, we've had to build some proprietary tech to eliminate safe ads and ads who maybe have sponsorships from brands that aren't safe. So you're totally right. There's a massive alignment of these factors. And I wouldn't say that any one of our partners comes to us and says, oh my gosh, I can't believe you solved all these worries in three spaces, but it's certainly easier to get into conversations with carriers and to have them appreciate what we've built in terms of even how we've architected our personalization. Right? Everybody wants personalization, Mike, but at the same time, in an opposite vector, everybody wants to control their data.
Yep.
So we've had to build our personalization engine from the ground up so that we actually never see the data. But you can see a personalized experience by leveraging the way the device can perform. Yeah. In the same way that your Face ID, you never see your face, but it's stored on your phone.
Yeah, it's encrypted. Device. And no, absolutely. And environmentally speaking, it seems like the ground is fertile for what you're offering in terms of timing. So that's great. And you mentioned carriers. We want to dive into the carrier relationship. But first, we're going to pause for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Greg Wester. Hello everyone, this is Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick and mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com. So we're back. My guest is Greg Wester. So Greg, before the break, we were talking about some of the different constituents that Mobile Posse has, you know, and we talked about users and what you're doing to create an environment for users in terms of a front-end interface on their mobile devices. So now let's switch gears and talk about another constituent that you alluded to a few times, which is carriers. I think that's the one you work with most directly in terms of getting that kind of on-deck positioning, as we used to say. This actually, it reminds me of pre-iPhone, which I'm sure you remember, before there was like an iOS open platform, really the only way to get your software and experiences in front of users was to get that carrier relationship, and it was so coveted and it was such a pole position. So you have the, you know, you enjoy the benefits of that almost, it seems. But tell us a little bit about that carrier relationship and what that looks like in terms of like a revenue model, even in terms of how that's packaged and how you bring that to them.
Sure. So I guess I'll start with the big picture first. Carriers have been the entities really footing the bill to bring mobile connectivity to everybody. They certainly make money from that in a competitive environment from you and I. When I decide to subscribe to T-Mobile and you decide to subscribe to AT&T, they make that revenue. But on top of that infrastructure, on top of that investment, there have been, and we've mentioned several of them already, Facebook and Google and Uber and everybody else who's profiting from that investment. Google and Facebook own some dominant share of the mobile advertising world. Mm-hmm. Most of the mobile advertising goes over mobile data plans. So on top of the investment from the big three, somebody else is making mobile advertising revenue.
The duopoly market share, I know this because I looked it up the other day, it's between 60 and 70% of U.S. mobile ad dollars.
So 60 to 70% of U.S. mobile ad dollars are being made by companies that have made no investment in the infrastructure.
Yep, there you go.
Where that money is made, which you could imagine if you are at one of the big telecom companies, that's a little bit frustrating. You've got to figure out, how can I use my pipes to make money via the content sold over the pipes? And that's often done in advertising. So,
and you see a move towards that as a quick side. Oh, I mean, Verizon and all of the M&A activity and getting more into content, getting more into ad network and ad tech, you see that happening for sure.
Yeah, and we look at a lot of that and actually put much of what's going on there as uphill battles.
Yep.
Right? They're getting into video where there are entrenched leaders and you've got a win share, getting into cable where there are entrenched folks and you've got a win share.
Yep.
As opposed to our solution,
your best of breed.
Which and is also a device centric. So here in the US, you typically get your device from your carrier. That device is equipped as the carrier mandates over in Asia. They've got clout with the OEMs to say, pre-install this technology. I want my phones to work like X. I want my phones to look like Y. So we work with the carriers and the OEMs in Asia to create that software that can be pre-installed. It could be a launcher. It could be an application. It could be an agent. It could be the default page on a web portal. Any of these experiences that a consumer uses to consume content, we make it a lot better for them. We typically then, you know, with the exception of out of home, where there's content, there is advertising, right? Out of home is the one advertising environment where it's only an ad, there's no content. We manage the content. Inside the content, we manage the advertising. We go out and our ad stack is plugged into all of the programmatic and RTB and header bidding so that the revenues come to us. And then we share those ad revenues with our carrier partner in return for their distribution. So it's a symbiotic relationship, but it also is one that is extraordinarily turnkey and gives them, since there are no CapEx or capital expenditures to get the service off the ground, mm-hmm. and there are no OPEX or operating expenditures to maintain the service, the revenue that we give to them is pure profit.
Absolutely. And let's dig a little bit more into the value they're seeing that you're bringing them. And you just alluded to a few things. So one, it seems like it's an environment where they could monetize through ads, and that's a kind of revenue diversification play. And also, it would seem like perhaps more intangible but valuable is them investing in their front-end experience towards a retention play for their users, which, of course, with carriers, retention, reducing churn is of course, a major success factor. So are those correct, or what other things are like, you know, are they getting out of it?
Yeah, so you're spot on. There's certainly revenue. But in addition to revenue, there is just heightened consumer experiences and differentiation from the other guy. Mm. So we work with each partner to incorporate the carrier's own content that they might have made investments in, right? As you mentioned earlier, a lot of telecom companies are going out and investing in media. So our distribution of that content through our channel is a protective insurance play, if you will. And then also, since we manage the entire system, we're a great value add to their own marketing departments.
Sure.
That are either doing CRM messages or overall brand messaging so that folks understand that everything the carrier brings to them. This will be increasingly critical as we get into the world, the real world of 5G.
Sure.
I would argue now, Mike, that network quality is no longer a differentiation between the carriers and doesn't cause someone to switch from carrier A to carrier B. It was 10 years ago, but I just can't imagine that it is now. But as the carriers start to deploy at different rates in different cities, 5G services, I believe you're going to see that happen all over again. And when that begins to happen, messaging around the status of your 5G, what can be done on your 5G, when you're going to get 5G, are all going to be hypercritical in maintaining and growing the overall ARPU from your subscriber.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And let's stop and kind of define 5G, because it's a term that's thrown around a lot. And I think a lot of people think of it as much faster speeds, which is certainly the case. But I think another interesting aspect to this that goes into your point is that the actual technology itself is a low-range, high-frequency signal. So as opposed to the cell towers we're used to today that are miles apart, you're going to have base stations that are, you know, a function of, you know, hundreds of yards apart. So that's going to enable location signal tracking that is triangulated a lot better because these base stations are more densely clustered. That, in addition to the high-frequency signal, mean we're talking about millimeter-level precision as opposed to some of the, you know, if you're in an urban canyon and you look down at that little blue dot on your phone and Google Maps and it's off by half a block. But in terms of like targeted messaging along the lines of your kind of CRM messaging, as you mentioned, with this kind of utility for users to inform them of things that they can opt in for, that seems like it can be done in a more precise way just based on that millimeter level tracking of exactly where they are and several other things. But that just being one of them that's usually top of mind for me, and that we at Street Fighter are big on kind of location as a signal.
Absolutely. And while the device and the network can support that, really understanding what's the user experience and the user interface that turns that ability into something that builds loyalty as opposed to something that corrupts or disrupts loyalty,
sure,
is really important. So having a platform that gives you more control than the OS would otherwise give you will be very important in this environment. And that's also at the core of our platform.
And like you said, it's all about that ARPU. And you know, that goes back to the churn and lifetime value kind of concept we mentioned earlier as well. So how do advertisers come into all of this? I'm fascinated by that as well, because it seems like an environment they would appreciate, because it's, you know, a safe environment for all the reasons we talked about earlier in terms of brand safety. And all of those benefits that they get, but how does that come into the picture in terms of the actual media ad buying process? Do you deal with advertisers directly, almost acting like an ad network, or is the carrier partner do that part? How does that kind of come into the picture?
Sure. We have our own ad operations team headed by our chief revenue officer. Mm-hmm. And it's largely a technical operation with dozens of levers that our team controls and optimizes, but behind it runs the ad tech as any other mobile company looking to monetize via advertising does.
Sure.
Right. So we work with all of the standard partners. We play them off each other as much as we can. We are actively testing and optimizing and are extremely diligent on running a traditional advertising business. What is most unique, however, are some of the ad experiences that we have. Not that the ads are different, but that the context of the content is different. So, you know, there's a trend that we talk about in today's world, going back to what you were talking about with apps, and the term we use is called being agnostic. Hmm. And being agnostic is the state of mind when you use your phone when you actually don't have an application in mind. It's you at Starbucks. You're looking to fill some time. You pick your phone up. You don't know where you want to go. Our research shows that 50% of all app unlocks as of 2019 are agnostic. You're looking for something, which means your mind is open. And when your mind is open for content, if you can take out the issues of decision choice overload and just give somebody content, in that content, if there's also advertising, you find that ad engagement and ad recall and ad awareness are actually better.
Yeah. And I can imagine the targeting abilities within that environment are a lot more precise than in other channels, even though in things like social, we have strong signals and other environments and options that advertisers have. That highly personalized environment, I would think, has some great kind of targeting signals to be utilized. And I like your thoughts on app-gnostic. One thing that I've been spending a lot of time looking at and reading about is how, a lot of computing, especially inputs and UI, are an abstraction layer, right? And the goal with computing should be to reduce those levels of abstraction. And apps, by definition, are another abstraction layer. So the ability to kind of, just have it be something that is more about the experience and not these packages it comes in is, I think, fascinating. I think that's where we're going to be kind of moving a lot in the future in mobile and other computing interfaces. So actually, before we go to our fun lightning round, our kind of final question here is, what are you most excited about that you're kind of working on now? And what can we expect from Mobile Posse in 2020?
Well, we're working on a couple things. Our product has really been optimized for media enthusiasts, and that's a massive portion. Over 40% of people today are media enthusiasts, consuming news, whether sports or social, three or more times a day across three or more of those categories I just mentioned. And we've optimized our product for that. It's the way we make, most of our money serving them. But we've realized that a massive growth opportunity is to go beyond that media enthusiast into folks that certainly consume news, weather, and sports, but to create a product and a solution that can really go for reach and not frequency. So super excited about that. We've got a big meeting coming up in a couple of days. We're revealing that solution. So we're excited about that. The
Nice.
second thing I'm super excited about is hyper casual gaming. So gaming on devices is the number one category in terms of time spent, and we've been testing some prototypes recently targeting gamers. I think 70% of all people play games, but only about 40% of all people would declare themselves as a gamer. But either way, those are two very large numbers. And playing hyper casual games is very often just something to do to fill some time in a day. And we've been testing some prototypes there, and it seems like we've got some very interesting opportunities working with some best-in-class game studios and game aggregators to do something there. And that's also extremely exciting. So I think those in 2020, those are the big areas
That's
for
great.
sure.
And that's actually something I looked up the other day because of a piece of research I was looking on in terms of different categories of mobile behavior, whether it be gaming, social, in terms of both frequency and session lengths. And gaming was through the roof. I think session lengths was something like average of 9 minutes, and high frequency as well. So I think and in terms of retention and active use over time. So it kind of hits all those marks. So that's exciting to see that you're moving into that. So we're going to pause for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Greg Wester. Hello everyone, this is Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick and mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com. So we're back. My guest is Greg Wester. So Greg, we were just spending a lot of time talking about Mobile Posse, the points of differentiation, a lot of fascinating kind of macro trends and how you're playing into those. So now we're going to kind of switch gears and find out a little bit more about you in our signature lightning round. So let's jump right into it. So what's something about you that few people know about?
I used to be incredibly awkwardly shy.
That's a good one. We haven't heard that. And actually, that seems like it's a kind of rare thing for kind of a C-level executive with your background, but something that just from this conversation I can ascertain is something that you have kind of worked through or faced. And, you know, you seem very personable. But so on to the next one. What's a profession you'd want to have if you weren't doing what you do now?
A fantasy land or reality land?
We can go with, you know, all of the above. There's no constraints. So Fantasyland.
Sure. Fantasyland. I think I probably would have loved to have been a professional tennis player. I still play at least once a week. Used to play competitively. And I guess I still have aspirations of being an advisor at a VC. It kind of takes the analyst work that we were talking about earlier and the marketing work that I certainly am doing now, but applying it in the high cadence world of VC.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you're seeing that a lot out there. It's actually surprisingly rare that you see almost like a, you know, a resident analyst at a VC firm. The only example I can point to is Benedict Evans at Andreessen Horowitz. Like that type of role seems so cool. And I agree, from the perspective of an analyst, that's like the dream gig.
Right.
So what is a company or tech startup that you think would be most exciting to be part of at early stages or the moment of inception, either a fly on the wall or like a participant?
You know, back just because as we were talking about psychology and consumers and technology and the fact that you have to figure out how to make money and all of it, I would have been fascinated to have been in the rooms when Zuckerberg was planning Facebook, right? We'd gone through MySpace and some of the other social networks, but to be in that room when he was contemplating where this might go, I think would have been fascinating for me.
It would have been also fascinating to see how much of the eventual roadmap was predetermined in those early days versus, you know, a lot of kind of pivoting and whatnot. So that I agree, that would be fascinating. So what is your favorite tech product or app to use as a consumer?
I talk a lot about frictionless media, and I would have to say Alexa is my favorite product. Alexa and its ecosystem of products as a recovering engineer, I like dabbling with all of the ecosystem around it, and it's certainly increased my consumption of jazz music, increased my consumption of news, and I know much more about the weather.
Yeah, there you go. And so I guess bonus question related to that is, what is your, you know, front end of choice? Because of course it is expanding, as you mentioned. You know, it went from, you know, Echo Home speakers. Their Echo event 2 weeks ago, you know, you probably saw they now have a lot of wearables, which my theory on that is that they are, you know, kind of leapfrogging the technology that they failed to market, you know, almost 10 years ago with the Fire Phone. They're now seeing saturation and maturity in the smartphone market. You can see that in Apple's earnings, where the rising star is wearables and the mature product is the iPhone. Right. I think Amazon is jumping on that. They have glasses, earbuds, a ring even. And I think just the hardware front end for Alexa is starting to expand so much. So where do you use it? All over the place? All over the house?
It is. I had to disconnect it in this room because I knew I might be talking about it and didn't want her talking back. So because I use it all over the house, my favorite is really just the Puck, and I have it in about half a dozen different rooms.
Is that the Dot? I think I have that. I think that's the one.
The
I
Dot.
Have. Yep.
Right. Right. And I really think that they are, because they can be, looking at this as a portfolio play. They know that many of these will probably die, but better than just creating one.
I agree. I think it's a numbers game, shotgun approach for them, at least with this hardware. And not to dwell too much on Alexa, but this reminds me of you having to turn yours off. I'm not sure if you saw this, but it was probably 2 or 3 years ago when South Park had an episode where they kind of pranked the whole audience, where they had these kind of, you know, audible cues throughout the episode to activate anyone who's watching if they have an Alexa in the room.
I miss that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's clever. Moving on, who's someone from the business world, and that could be someone alive and active today or historically, that you admire most?
Well, I'm torn. I'd like to give you two answers, I guess. One,
that's okay.
It's kind of the business world, but I would say my father, and I could get into that. And
sure.
Then I would certainly say Howard Anderson, who started Yankee Group and Battery Ventures. I learned a lot from that guy. I worked for him. And I know it's a name that most people don't know, but was certainly instrumental in my career.
And that sounds like a good analyst answer. I like that. So what is a superpower or superhero power, excuse me, that you would most want to have? And that gets back to, like, you know, fantasy world speculation.
Sure, sure. Boy, I would love to be able to shift time or go back and forth in time. I'm not sure what character that was. Certainly, yeah. Superman.
It doesn't have to be a specific character, but just a generic power. And you're right, Superman did at one point, didn't he, like, fly around the globe and reverse the polarity to reverse
Einstein would be rolling over in his grave. Yeah. But, you know, time is our most precious commodity.
Sure.
And as the expression says, you never get a chance to make a second chance, right. But if you have time shifting, you certainly could. So I would go with that.
Great, a good answer. So what are some passions or hobbies that help you mentally unplug from work? You mentioned tennis. You can go with that answer.
That's one of them for sure, I guess, especially on a Friday, craft cocktails.
Nice. I like that one.
Sports massage therapy, tennis, and usually in the opposite order.
Yeah,
but not always.
And the Friday cocktails is also an analyst answer, if you know, from my perspective of being in the field. Lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of the year and into 2020?
Nothing extravagant. Mm-hmm. I guess better dad, better husband, better manager, and I'm shooting for a 5-minute plank.
Ah, that's great. I like that one. Those are all actually good good goals. And that's actually a great place to end it. So that's all the time we have. I want to thank you, Greg, for spending time with us.
Mike, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, this has been fun. Thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Also, stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.